Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Chiaroscuro woodcuts simulate three-dimensional form through the successive impression of relief cut blocks that define areas of dark and light. This style of printmaking flourished in 16th century Italy, interpreting works by such masters as Raphael, Parmigianino, and Titian, and boasting extraordinary craft as well as often striking palettes. Yet questions remain. Exactly how were chiaroscuros created? In what sequence were the blocks printed, and why? In this lecture, recorded on October 14, 2018 at the National Gallery of Art, Naoko Takahatake discusses the chiaroscuro woodcut as one of the most beautiful developments in the history of printmaking. The chiaroscuro woodcut in Renaissance Italy is on view through January 20, 2019.
On July 24, 1516, the printmaker Ugo da Carpi wrote to the Venetian Senate claiming he had developed a new printmaking technique. He described his discovery as a beautiful method for printing with woodblocks in chiaro e scuro, in light and dark, and asked the Senate to grant him a privilege that would protect it against copyists. In requesting such an exceptional privilege, Ugo had undoubtedly recognized the extraordinary nature and appeal of this pioneering color printmaking technique, and was eager to guard his investments against competitors. And on the left, you see Ugo da Carpi's first chiaroscuro woodcut, which was likely made at the time he requested this privilege. And on the right is the document itself. Ugo's concerns about piracy were not without reason. The chiaroscuro process, in fact, originated in the first decade of the 16th century in Northern Europe. Ugo likely saw an example of a northern chiaroscuro woodcut and reversed engineered the process to create his own prints. Acknowledging the northern invention of the technique, however, does not diminish the significance of Ugo's contribution to as the Italian progenitor of the medium. And on the screen you have two examples of early northern chiaroscuros, and I'll just point out that where you see an asterisk in the caption, those are works that are not in the exhibition. You'll find that what I'm showing is mostly in the exhibition. Ugo forged a new market for these novel prints, and his example in turn inspired talented printmakers, painters, and printers south of the Alps through the century to explore the technique, expand its use, and broaden its audience. The chiaroscuro woodcut became a predominantly Italian phenomenon, as it was only in Italy that there was a continuous production by a number of specialists over a long period of time. In fact, the technique became so naturalized that the Italian term chiaroscuro woodcut is now commonly applied to describe northern examples as well. The term chiaroscuro refers to the modeling of form using light and shadow, and the chiaroscuro woodcut entails printing an image using multiple woodblocks that are printed in different shades of a single hue. It was one of the earliest techniques for printing in color in Europe, and their appearance must have been quite striking to its Renaissance audiences. Printed pictorial images using a woodblock matrix, black ink, and paper were created in Europe from the second half of the 14th century. At the start of the 16th century, prints were predominantly linear, black and white images pulled from the designs that were carved in a woodblock, as you see here, or engraved on a copper plate. While woodcuts had been colored by hand in the 15th century, this practice of embellishing prints with paint had largely ceased by the time the chiaroscuro woodcut was invented. It is important to note that the formal language of the chiaroscuro woodcut did not derive from such hand color woodcuts. Rather, the aesthetic origins of the chiaroscuro woodcut can be found in specialized types of monochromatic workshop drawings. These drawings were typically executed on a colored ground with metal point, pen, or brush used to delineate the contours. Shading of increasing density was added to indicate the deepest recesses, while white highlights marked the most elevated or reflective surfaces. Bringing together a new printmaking technology with the ancient aesthetic principle of monochrome, the chiaroscuro woodcut captured the imagination of artists and generated excitement within an elite circle of humanist collectors. Following its introduction in Titian's Venice, the technique took root in Raphael's circle in Rome, and quickly spread to secondary artistic centers throughout the peninsula, next by Parmigianino in Bologna and Domenico Beccafumi in Siena. These innovative color prints were embraced as a means of disseminating artist designs and prized as works of art in their own right. No less a contemporary critic than Giorgio Vasari in his Lives of the Artist praised the technique's inventiveness and beauty while also noting its difficulty. They were actively collected from their inception through the following five centuries, finding their way from Renaissance workshops into collections around the world. And yet, despite the high esteem with which the technique has been regarded since the time they were made, it has surprisingly remained one of the least understood phenomena of early printmaking. Much confusion around the attribution and chronology of Italian chiaroscuro woodcuts has persisted, which has impeded a clear view of their creative evolution. There are a number of reasons for this. For one, the complex technique has eluded systematic cataloging, because, as you will see, it inclines to many variations during the printing process. Second, chiaroscuro woodcuts are among the most rare of Renaissance prints. An elite share of the print trade, only some 180 16th century chiaroscuro compositions are known today, each one known in relatively limited numbers of impressions. What is more, we are faced with a paucity of early documents, a general lack of names and dates on the prints, and obscure identities of many of its practitioners. My study of chiaroscuro woodcuts began around 2006 as an intern in the Old Master Prints Department here at the gallery. Housed nearby the Library of Congress is an extraordinary collection of Italian chiaroscuro woodcuts, which was compiled in England in the late 17th and early 17th centuries by the Earls of Pembroke at Wilton House. This collection, once gathered in an album, is notable for the sheer number of chiaroscuros it contains, but also the rarity and high quality of many of its impressions, and there are 17 prints from that collection in the exhibition. One of its greatest treasures is this chiaroscuro woodcut by Domenico Beccafumi made in the 1540s. Beccafumi's apostle is noble and imposing. His monumental sculptural body appears weighted down by voluminous garments that twist and curve, following its emphatic sinuous sway. The sumptuous brick red combined with the luminous white reserves of paper creates especially rich and dramatic chiaroscuro effects. Equally stunning is the energetic cutting that vigorously asserts the materiality of the wood, a proto-expressionist handling of the woodcut medium. A number of questions immediately surfaced upon viewing this extraordinary work. How was this print and others like it made? How did Beccafumi learn the process? And what techniques and materials did he use? What motivated the artist to take up this laborious and experimental technique? And given the distinguished aesthetic merits of these works, why are so few of them known? These are just some of the questions that have propelled a decade of research, which has culminated in the current exhibition. This is an installation shot from Los Angeles. I encourage you to see the exhibition here. The first comprehensive study of the technique's origins and process, this exhibition traces technical and formal developments, the diversification of artistic styles, subjects, scale, and functions, as well as the evolving aesthetic of color. With the accompanying catalog, the exhibition addresses such far-reaching questions as artistic collaboration, the diffusion of images and transmission of style, as well as taste and collecting during the Renaissance. This afternoon, I will provide a brief overview of the exhibition, which features some 100 chiaroscuro woodcuts from 19 American and British collections, alongside related engravings, drawings, and sculpture. Later in my presentation, I will also discuss some of the technical research undertaken with conservators and scientists, which brought new depth to our understanding of chiaroscuro workshop practice. But first, what is a chiaroscuro woodcut and how is it made? The chiaroscuro woodcut involves printing an image from two or more woodblocks, each block printed using a different color ink. In a two-block chiaroscuro woodcut, as you see on the right, the first block is executed like a conventional woodcut, as you see on the left, printed with black ink and on a white sheet of paper. Tone and highlights are designed and cut from a second block. Here what you see is the tone block that's printed in blue, and then what you see as white are just uninked areas of the paper. So those are white reserves that you're seeing coming through the ink. The white highlights, therefore, are cut from the second block in this impression. Printed together, the two blocks and the white reserves of paper emulate a heightened drawing on tinted paper. Intermediate tones could be produced by printing additional blocks, thus suggesting the manner of a pen, ink, and wash drawing, or achieving the painterly qualities akin to a work in oil. Such chiaroscuros were less reliant on a single dominant linear block, as is the case in this example, which is printed from four blocks. So unlike the previous example where the composition was articulated in black line, here the design is distributed over four different blocks. So you have a light brown, a medium brown, and then a darker brown in some of these details, and then the black. And I think now things will become even more clear. So illustrated here are the three blocks of a chiaroscuro woodcut, which were made in 2008, copying a Renaissance design. And there are, in fact, no blocks from the Renaissance which are known to survive. Below each of the blocks are impressions that are printed from the block independently. And then to print the chiaroscuro woodcut, you would print each of these in succession onto a single sheet of paper. And so seen in this way, you can see the function of each of the three blocks. So on the left, we would call this a light tone block, and that establishes the overall background. And again, the white highlights are just the reserves of paper. So those are the areas that did not, that were carved away from the block and therefore are not inked, and it reveals the paper underneath. And then this middle tone block, which I would call a compositional block because it does hold the majority of the composition. And here is the darkest block, which reinforces some of the contours and also expresses the deepest areas of shadow. So this is the scuro of the chiaroscuro. And I'll also just point out that this is a relief process. So what that means is only the areas of the block that are uncut or that stand in relief on the block are those areas that will print. So I think you can see it well here. So these areas that were not cut, that's the surface of the block, that is what is going to print. And of course, we're also dealing with the issue of reversal, that the image that you see in the block will be printed, will appear in reverse once it is printed on the sheet of paper. Now, once they were cut, printing the blocks for a chiaroscuro woodcut was also an elaborate multi-stage process. Each block was inked in a different color, and the blocks were printed in succession, commonly from the lightest color to the darkest. And in order to ensure the designs of the different blocks were accurately aligned, the sheet of paper and block were placed in the same position each time they were run through the press. And what I'm showing you here is an example of a misregistered block, so where one of the blocks was not placed in the same position as the others when it was run through the press. And so you can see that this block, the darkest block, is a little bit below, and so the entire image sort of starts to fall apart. A key characteristic of the chiaroscuro woodcut is the ability to print the same blocks but using different colored inks, and thus replicate an image in a variety of palettes. Changes in palette can impact the tonal relations within an image, that is to say, its chiaroscuro effects, and could also alter the mood of a subject. So these were printed using the exact same two wood blocks. So I'm going to go over this one more time. So here you have the linear design that is printed using one block in black, and then this red background is printed from a second block, and the white highlights are the reserves of paper. And so these two impressions were printed using the exact same two blocks, but this one was printed with black ink and blue ink, and this one in the red and black ink. And on the left, the darker value of the tone block printed in that beautiful blue contrasts more dramatically with the white highlights, thus heightening the tenebrous rendering of a drawing of a dark interior illuminated with a flame. The processes I have described can involve a variety of hands, those of a designer who conceived the composition, the block cutter who carved the blocks, and the printer who prepared the color inks and printed the blocks on a press. Alternatively, these steps could have been performed by a single individual. As we shall see, a single designer could collaborate at one time with different printmakers of varying skills, or conversely, a single printmaker could have worked from the designs of different artists of contrasting styles. Thus, understanding the working relationship between the designer, printmaker, and printer is essential to clarifying the authorship of a given print. While previous studies have tended to approach chiaroscuro woodcuts according to their designers or individual printmakers, this exhibition, arranged in six main chronologically ordered sections, groups the chiaroscuros according to the workshops that issued them. Our study has placed new emphasis on the material evidence of the prints, including their inks, papers, and printing procedures. This approach has resolved many long-disputed attributions, untangled conflicting chronologies, and elucidated the historical progression of the technique. The history of the chiaroscuro woodcut, as I noted at the start, begins in Italy with Ugo da Carpi, a professional printmaker. A man of aristocratic birth, we know nothing of his formal training. In addition to 15 chiaroscuros, he produced a variety of conventional black and white woodcuts and one painting. It's important to note that Ugo did not conceive his own designs. Rather, he was reliant on models that were at times supplied to him by an artist, as was the case in this Saint Jerome. Here, the linear design, which transmits the vitality of Titian's energetic draftsmanship, may have been laid down by the painter onto the block or transferred from a model drawing or modello. And on the right, I'm showing you an example of Titian's draftsmanship to illustrate just how lively his pen work is and the challenge that Ugo faced in trying to capture the artist's vigorous line work in wood. And I will also note here just how prominently Titian's name is placed in the center of the composition, and his own name is included in small letters modestly concealed in the design. And as his confidence and ambition grew, so did the size of his signature. After executing this first chiaroscuro in Venice, Ugo went on to issue the majority of his oeuvre in Rome, where he resettled by 1518. These Roman works were all after designs by Raphael and artists in his circle. Through his chiaroscuros, datable to around 1516 to 1518, we witness his rapidly advancing technical proficiency from a basic two-block approach, on your far left, to his introduction of a third mid-tone block, as you see in the center. And here you have the light tone block, which is this light green, the darkest block in black, and then here is where you see this middle green color, which is the mid-tone block. And then eventually to the full orchestration of a four-block design, as you see on your right. Ugo's move to Rome around 1516-17 was doubtless motivated by his knowledge of the prints being produced after the designs of Raphael. Starting in the early 15-teens, Raphael had encouraged the production of engravings that circulated his designs beyond the confines of Roman churches and palaces, demonstrating to an international audience his magisterial command of design and modern style rooted in study of ancient art. And on the left is one of a few drawings Raphael made in preparation for the engraving on the right by Marcantonio Raimondi. But by the time of Ugo's arrival in the Eternal City, Raphael was overburdened with painting commissions and architectural projects, and it appears Ugo was unable to collaborate with the painter in the way engravers like Marcantonio and Raimondi had done in the preceding years. While Ugo apparently obtained a few Raphael drawings for his chiaroscuros, in several instances, he availed himself of engravings after the painter's designs, which were much more easily accessible. One example is the Massacre of the Innocents. The engraving of 1514-1515 was the acknowledged masterwork of Raphael's collaboration with the engraver Marcantonio Raimondi. By selecting this engraving as a model for his chiaroscuro, Ugo was inviting comparison and declaring his skill. And in these details, you can see the relative advantages and limitations of the engraving and chiaroscuro techniques. So engraving entails incising lines into a copper plate using a sharp tool called a burin, and it could achieve extremely fine linear detail. However, creating tone was more laborious as it required combining parallel and cross-hatching of different densities. Conversely, chiaroscuro inclines to tonal planes, but to print fine lines was extremely challenging as it required cutting around the web of lines, only leaving in relief the marks to be printed. And I just like to call attention to such details as this beautiful rendering of the hair. Here in the woodcut, it really is so finely cut and finished that it looks like pen work. In its contours, Ugo's woodcut conforms almost exactly to Marcantonio's composition and must have been executed by transferring the image directly onto the blocks from a printed impression. This print exemplifies Ugo's total command of his craft, combining intelligent block design with precise cutting, refined inks, and flawless printing. Ugo da Carpi's example inspired painters and printmakers south of the Alps to explore the medium and expand its use. Crucially, he entered into a partnership with the painter Francesco Mazzola called Parmigianino, who in 1527 fled Rome during the sack and established a workshop in Bologna in further north in Italy. According to Vasari, during his 3 years in Bologna, Parmigianino worked not only with Ugo da Carpi, but also with a second block cutter, Antonio da Trento, to issue a total of 8 chiaroscuro prints. These prints, which you will see in the second room of the exhibition, match the painter's fluent and graceful draftsmanship with skilled cutting and sophisticated inks, and reveal an intimacy of collaboration between the artist and his block cutters. The partnership between Parmigianino and Ugo da Carpi resulted in Diogenes, arguably the most accomplished chiaroscuro woodcut of the Renaissance. The Greek philosopher Diogenes of Sinope is shown seated before the barrel he made his home. You see the barrel behind him. A plucked chicken to the right alludes to his sarcastic rejection of Plato's description of man as a species of featherless biped. In this ambitious composition, Ugo used 4 interlocking and overlapping planes of color to articulate Diogenes' strained musculature, to capture the fluid movement of drapery, and to render the distinctive texture of the fowl's exposed skin. This portrayal of Diogenes exemplifies the erudite nature of many chiaroscuro subjects, which were meant to appeal to the humanist leanings of the early collector. A highlight of the exhibition is this trio of impressions. In the earliest of the 3, which you see on your far left, printed in blue, the overlapping sheer inks optically blend to create intermediate values, yielding fluid transitions between block designs and a compelling sense of volume. So I think of it as overlapping panes of tinted colored glass, where when you overlap them, you start to create additional colors optically, but it's not a physical blending of the colors. Their narrow chromatic range, and by that I mean a transition from a light blue to a darker blue and yet a darker blue, this narrow chromatic range further unifies the composition tonally. Comparison of this impression with the latest of the 3 reveals how the selection of ink colors and their formulation are crucial to the success of the final print. And I should note that in terms of the chromatic range, these were printed in close together in time, and the block wear is minimal between these 3 impressions. So we're really focusing on the printing inks. In the blue example, the transitions are seamless, and it is extremely difficult to individuate the design of each of the 4 blocks. In the latest of the 3, which is printed in a light olive, a darker olive, and then 2 browns, the colors are less harmonious, and the inks are less translucent, thus creating staccato zones of color. The darkest block emphasizes the surface, thus flattening the composition. And you'll note, for example, that you can distinguish the shape of the darkest block here in the impression on the right, whereas when you go back to that earliest impression, it's very hard to distinguish the actual design of the four separate blocks. Ugo must have passed on his technical knowledge to Antonio da Trento in Parmigianino's shop, as their Bolognese prints share inks, papers, and printing traits. Other details of Antonio's career, however, remain obscure. Of his five securely attributed prints, only two bear his initials and none is dated. His closeness to Parmigianino is revealed by the sensitivity with which he transmits the artist's calligraphic line. And you see that especially well in this print here of Augustus and the Tiburtine Sibyl, and you see Parmigianino's characteristic long, fluid strokes. In a clearing in a wood, an elegant, naked youth sits with his back to the viewer. Although his face and action are hidden from the viewer, some have identified him as Ovid's Narcissus, adoring his own image in a pool of water, and accordingly, the figure at lower left as the nymph Echo. Full of sadness and seemingly melting into the forest floor, she yearns for the young man of legendary beauty who has scorned her love. Four extant drawings attest to Parmigianino's careful planning of this poetic image. One drawing is a focused figure study of the male nude. Executed in black and white chalks, this life study attentively articulates the fall of light across the surface of the man's back. In a second drawing, on the right, this one in pen, Parmigianino developed parts of the forest landscape through a meticulous rendering of dense foliage at the foot of a tree. Parmigianino ultimately realized a coherent and balanced design, integrating the graceful figure of Narcissus within the verdant landscape that is illuminated from the right. Antonio printed this composition in a variety of palettes. While the green impression, with its stronger contrasts, creates the sense of the figures that the figures are set deep in the forest covering, the scene in pale brown appears bathed in warm light, its delicate highlights resplendent. Parmigianino's Bolognese chiaroscuro workshop dissolved within a few years of its founding, an event Vasari attributes to Antonio da Trento's alleged theft of the painter's drawings, copper plates, and woodblocks. Parmigianino recovered his printing materials, which were cumbersome and likely left behind by the thief who wished to make a quick escape. However, he lost his drawings and abandoned printmaking upon returning to his native Parma in 1530. The abrupt end to Parmigianino's printmaking is regrettable, as some of the 16th century's most beautiful, sophisticated chiaroscuros were produced in his workshop. But the theft of the drawing seems, in its own unexpected way, to have contributed to the technique's continued progress beyond Parmigianino's lifetime. In the following decade, a cache of Parmigianino drawings, perhaps the very ones that had been taken by Antonio da Trento, entered into the hands of the printmaker Giuseppe Niccolo Vicentino, who operated the most prolific chiaroscuro shop. Few biographical details are known about Vicentino. His name applies origins in the Veneto, and Vasari placed his activity after Parmigianino's death in 1540. Although only five chiaroscuros bear Vicentino's name, and none are dated, a great many unsigned works can be associated with his workshop. And this is an example of a print that does bear Vicentino's signature, and it is after a drawing by Parmigianino. Vicentino worked independently of the artists whose designs he used, including ones by Parmigianino, as we just saw, and by Raphael. And this drawing by Raphael dates to around 1514 and was preparatory for one of the 10 tapestries commissioned to the artist by the Pope for the Sistine Chapel. The drawing, therefore, was never intended to be a model for a print and was reused or repurposed several decades after its original use. Vicentino's workshop introduced strikingly bold, saturated colors to the Italian chiaroscuro woodcut and prioritized expediency in his production methods. Inks were frequently prepared with coarsely ground pigments and applied in thick layers. The substantial survival of impressions from the workshop testifies at once to the success of his commercialized practice and to the broadening audience for Italian chiaroscuro woodcuts. Given the size of the output, it is likely that Vicentino's shop employed different printmakers to cut woodblocks. One of these printmakers may well have been Antonio da Trento, who we will recall had stolen Parmigianino's drawings. The print here, the fine linear treatment of the print here agrees with Antonio's cutting style. However, its inks and printing procedures are consonant with Vicentino's workshop output, and to this point we shall return later. Now, this print was one of two issued from Vicentino's shop, which were modeled on the same Parmigianino drawing, which you see on the left, which is executed in pen with washes and white heightening. In the red two-block version, linear hatching and cross-hatching of varying density articulate the two darker washes. The blue four-block chiaroscuro, on the other hand, emphasizes the drawing's painterly qualities, its mid-blocks printing broad planes of color to approximate the different tonalities of washes. And so by that I mean here you see that you have hatching that is of different densities, or also changing the direction of the line work to distinguish the different tonalities of the washes. Whereas in this case, we have just different use of different colored inks of different darknesses to render the, to translate the drawing. These two chiaroscuros illustrate the workshop's interest in exploiting the aesthetic range of distinct technical approaches. The chiaroscuro printmakers discussed thus far, Ugo da Carpi, Antonio da Trento, and Niccolò Vicentino, relied entirely on designs of other artists. Domenico Beccafumi, on the other hand, was exceptional in that he designed, cut, and engraved and printed his own woodblocks and copper plates. The foremost artistic personality of his native Siena, Beccafumi was charged with many of the city's most prestigious commissions for paintings, marble inlay designs, and sculpture. He turned to printmaking in the final decade of his career, producing 9 chiaroscuro woodcuts, as well as 6 engravings printed with tonal woodblocks, a hybrid mixed technique. Beccafumi's prints are immediate, spirited expressions of his fertile imagination. The artist probed the possibilities of the chiaroscuro process at each stage of production. He used unconventional tools for cutting and exploited fully the technique's inherent potential for variation, altering and substituting blocks, and changing the manner he inked and printed them. The artist executed this drawing on the left in direct preparation for a mixed technique print, which combines an engraving with a tonal woodcut. He broadly sketched out the composition, exploring the figural forms with his characteristic trembling lines, thoughtfully determining the distribution of chiaro and scuro. The artist used a lightly colored ground to approximate the mid-tone of the eventual print. From this intermediate tone, he worked upward into lights using white heightening and downward into darks using black chalk and wash. From the start, Beccafumi conceived of 3 male nudes as a chiaroscuro print. At the bottom right, what I like to call the naked variant, the engraving is legible as an image. However, the engraving itself provides only the outline of the design and the deepest of shadows. The tone block is required to complete the image and give the composition its depth and the figures their volume. Beccafumi's chiaroscuro apostle figures exemplify his distinctive individual style that was at once rooted in Sienese tradition and embraced the aesthetics of modern maniera. The pronounced contrapposto of the figure, exaggerated by the swath of draperies that adhere to his body, is characteristic of Beccafumi's bold style, as are the rubbery bend of the figure's curling arm, strong nose, and tufted beard. These prints, like the drawing at left, display the artist's facility for moving back and forth between positive and negative, between tone, line, and reserve. The character of his tremulous line and his fragile contours that dissipate in the shadows is likewise captured in the splintered edges of his brittle woodcut lines. Alongside the major practitioners, other painters and printmakers in Italy also explored the medium to great creative ends. As enthusiasm for the process spread to new centers, different artistic styles were espoused. Notably, the painters Antonio Campi, Federico Barocci, and Marco Pino respectively took up the technique in Cremona, Urbino, and Naples, cities that were not major print publishing centers. The outputs of these smaller workshops, often by artists and printmakers who engaged only occasionally with the technique, was generally limited not only in the numbers of compositions that were cut, but also in the impressions that were printed. The designs of Titian and Raphael, which were instrumental to the early development of the chiaroscuro woodcut, remained important sources for practitioners in late century. As we see here on the right, the gallery's chiaroscuro by Niccolò Boldrini, the last Venetian chiaroscurist of the Renaissance, which is after a Raphael school design. Importantly, Boldrini also introduced new subjects, including landscape and genre, disclosing a continued ambition to modernize the technique. Some fascinating insight into late chiaroscuro production is provided by the legal proceedings between the painter Marco Pino and the printmaker Antonio Spano, dating to 1575 and now in the Naples archives. In these documents, we find Spano's declaration that he had spent 3 to 4 months living in the painter Pino's home in order to make a chiaroscuro woodcut depicting Perseus. Spano claims that the two men had expected to make substantial profits from this print, but fell into disagreement over the division of proceeds. Spano abandoned the project and the blocks remained in Pino's possession, which the printmaker valued at the considerable sum of 500 ducats. This testimony is not only allows us to attribute this unsigned print depicting Perseus after Pino, but it also reveals how, at this late moment in Naples, an artist made a substantial investment in chiaroscuro, believing it would be lucrative. The 16th century chiaroscuro woodcut culminates in the work of Andrea Andreani. In a career spanning 3 decades, Andreani produced some 35 chiaroscuro woodcuts and 6 conventional woodcuts. He primarily adopted designs by artists in the various centers of his activity, namely Florence, Siena, and his native Mantua, working collaboratively with esteemed living artists, while also appropriating inventions of celebrated masters of earlier generations. Andreani brought considerable ambition to the technique, quickly becoming its most accomplished practitioner of late century. Notably, he was the first to look beyond traditional graphic and painted models sources for his models. These 3 views of Giambologna's famous Rape of a Sabine are the earliest Italian chiaroscuros to record a sculptural work. They capture the drama of Giambologna's plastic depiction of 3 interlocking figures spiraling upwards by providing multiple viewpoints. Given its 4-meter height, that is, of the marble sculpture, the print's designer could hardly have studied these eye-level views, which was unveiled, and the sculpture was unveiled in 1583. More likely, he executed drawings in the sculptor's studio, perhaps studying small-scale models, similar in size to the bronze casting in the exhibition. Andreani interpreted a great range of subjects, including this austere still life or this unprecedented architectural print. The work on the right, with its idealized views of Siena, depicts a theater stage design. Often overlooked is the technical virtuosity of Andreani's prints, which is here demonstrated by a fine description of detail, sophisticated use of color gradation for atmospheric perspective, and expertly cut calligraphic inscription. And these letters are not type letters, but they are actually cut from wood. Andreani was the first to create monumental chiaroscuros printed from multiple sets of blocks on 2 or more joined sheets of paper. His Triumph of Caesar, which recorded the 9 canvases by Andrea Mantegna from around 1485, is printed on 11 sheets of paper using a total of 43 woodblocks and achieves the grand pictorial scale of painting. Andreani spent 4 years to complete the work, which was to be his last major endeavor. While he successfully brought the technique to new heights, Andreani's chiaroscuros represents the technique's final flourishing in the 16th century. By the mid-17th century, the chiaroscuro woodcut was to fall out of fashion, only to enjoy a brief revival in the 1800s. Largely retrospective in character, these later examples were unsuccessful in recapturing the remarkable vitality of the Renaissance chiaroscuro. Indeed, this exhibition conveys the enthusiasm and energy with which 16th century chiaroscurists embraced challenges and delighted in experiment. It celebrates the originality, virtuosity, and beauty of their contributions to the art of printmaking in Renaissance Italy. Because chiaroscuros are associated with some of the finest painters and draftsmen of the age, far more attention has previously been given to their designs and styles than to their technique and facture. As I noted earlier, our study has shifted the emphasis, focusing more on the physical aspects of the prints themselves, that is to say, their inks, papers, and printing. In the time that remains, I would like to present some of the methods we use to address problematic attributions that have persisted in the literature. Study of the material traits of prints has been critical to reestablishing the oeuvre of Niccolò Vicentino. Many of his unsigned prints were previously attributed to Ugo da Carpi. The chief argument for subsuming works by Vicentino into Ugo's oeuvre was the authorship of their designs, that is to say, their common reliance on Raphael and Parmigianino. However, close study of the block cutting technique and other material clues have provided new grounds for identifying Vicentino's output. Some informative traces can be found on the backs or versos of the prints, which of course you do not see in the exhibition. For example, on the verso of this Saturn in the British Museum are printed proofs of two tone blocks from The Virgin and Child with Saints, a chiaroscuro that is signed by Vicentino. So we're looking here at the verso of this print, so you can make out the composition coming through the paper here. And these are two printed proofs of this print here, which is bears Vicentino's name. In other words, Vicentino's printer took test impressions of the blocks from the signed Virgin and Child with Saints and later reused the same sheet of printer to use the same sheet of paper to print the Saturn. In the case of the miraculous draft at the upper left, I've put forth an attribution to Vicentino on the basis of cutting technique, formulation of inks, printing quality, and block publishing history. The miraculous draft deploys a three-block method that bears a close affinity with Vicentino, as exemplified, for example, by his signed Christ Healing the Lepers. In both prints, you'll see that Vicentino uses the mid-tone block to describe the overall composition, most importantly, to describe details that are further back in the distance. He limits his use of the darkest block to describe the figures, and then the highlights as well are just placed within the foreground and in the figures, and it's the same here. This efficient formula for distributing a design over three blocks appears schematic when compared to Ugo's multi-block technique, for example, the Aeneas that you see on the right. Further support for an attribution to Vicentino can be found in the characteristics of printing, most specifically the color inks. We can see here that the workshop printed the miraculous draft in the same inks as Christ Healing the Lepers and Saturn, which we know are by Vicentino. These green inks are consistent in color, viscosity, and quality. The opaque inks are composed of coarsely ground pigment particles and laid down in thick layers. This contrasts with Ugo's refined translucent paints of inks in analogous hues. And so here what you're seeing at the underneath are photomicrographs of the print Ugo da Carpi print and of Vicentino print. I thank Linda Steiber-Marinus for these images. And you can see just how coarsely ground the inks are in the case of Vicentino. These are individual pigments that you're seeing and how you have these thick, opaque layers of ink. Whereas in the case of Ugo da Carpi, you have these translucent sheer films of ink. In order to interpret fully the material facts of chiaroscuro woodcuts, it was essential first to grasp fully the practicalities of how they were printed. A fundamental contribution to our knowledge came out of a series of printing experiments conceived in 2008 by Linda Steiber-Marinus, a former Library of Congress conservator and catalog contributor, which recreated the historical processes of preparing colored inks and printing chiaroscuro woodblocks. These experiments, a selection of which is described in the catalog, provided practical explanations for why certain variations exist between impressions. They illustrate how even small modifications to the method of printing or to the physical property of inks can have major aesthetic consequences, impacting the clarity of the block designs, the tonal relations between colors, and ultimately the coherence of the composition. And here you're getting a sense of the different stages of production. So Linda made these printing inks following early recipes, and this is the inking of the surface of the wood block, as is this, and here you see the printer placing the sheet onto the block on a registration frame, and that's the process of actually printing the block on a plan press, on a screw press. So I'll show you just a couple of examples of the printing experiments. So this is, what you're seeing here is an impression of one block, which was printed with the left sheet, what you see is the left-hand side, printed with a moistened sheet of paper, and then in the right half, the sheet was dry. So the dampened sheet was more supple and thus conformed intimately to the block, producing a continuous ink layer. When a sheet is printed dry, some paper shows through the uneven ink layer. So here you have a very flat, uniform printing of black, whereas here you see how it's there's some paper show through coming through the black ink. Now you would think that one would always want to print then with a moistened sheet of paper. However, a moistened sheet of paper shrinks once it is dry. And if you look at the detail on the top, this sheet of paper has actually shrunk, so the design no longer aligns, which of course in the case of chiaroscuro woodcut is especially problematic because you're dealing with the alignment and registration of multiple block designs. When printing chiaroscuro wood blocks in succession, here what was done was to allow the each ink layer to dry before the next layer was printed, that is in the impression on the left. So the yellow ochre ink was printed, and this was dry before this red ochre ink was printed, and that was dry before the black was printed. Whereas in the impression on the right, that printing process was accelerated. So the yellow ochre was printed first, and then while the yellow ochre was still wet, the red ochre was printed on top of it. And because the two ink layers are wet, they're actually physically mixing. And so even though the same red ink was used to print these two impressions, you can see how this one appears a bit more orange because you're getting the yellow ink coming through as well. And these sort of recreate different workshop practices that Linda and I had observed. For example, Ugoda Carpi's production, you will find this very, very careful printing of each block and allowing each ink layer to dry before the next, whereas Vicentino's accelerated process looks more like that. We also collaborated with LACMA's conservation scientists to study the colorants in chiaroscuro printing inks. Here, the colorants are being examined using X-ray fluorescence on the left and fiber optic reflectance spectroscopy. And I will not answer questions about those processes. We learned that the colorants used were among the cheaper ones available in the Renaissance and which were commonly used by painters. So these are some of the ingredients in the printing inks. That's linseed oil, so that's the binder. Carbon black and lead white, and these are ochres, siennas, vermilion, indigo, and verdigris. We also found orpiment, which is arsenic, and therefore we couldn't present it in the exhibition. Scientific analysis revealed the same unusual combination of this orpiment and carbon black in the darkest blocks gray ink in both Ugoda Carpi's Diogenes and Antonio da Trento's Virgin and Child with St. John the Baptist, both in LACMA's collection. This discovery bolstered the contention that the two prints were printed in the same workshop, where both printmakers collaborated with Parmigianino. The material findings also informed our understanding of artistic intention. We became aware of the dramatic shifts in color that had occurred in some impressions due to the use of unstable colorants. An example is a group of chiaroscuros that were printed in Niccolò Vicentino's workshop in verdigris, a copper-based pigment that corrodes. And on the right, you have the pure verdigris, and it's absolutely exquisite blue-green turquoise color. Although many sheets were printed with verdigris inks, many of the sheets that were printed with verdigris inks look, as you see them on the right, rather dull and brown. They were in fact a vibrant green at the time they were created, closer in condition to what you see on the left. The artist's and printmaker's conception of color was therefore radically different to what we could perceive in viewing the prints in their present condition. The Chiaroscuro Woodcut in Renaissance Italy exhibition and catalog are the first on the subject to incorporate such technical discoveries into the art historical assessment. While many questions remain, the fresh perspectives offered help connect us more closely to the Italian chiaroscuro workshops of the Renaissance and enhance our appreciation of this fascinating, complex, and exquisite art form. I hope that you will spend time in the exhibition to enjoy these visually arresting and innovative works in all of their material splendor. Thank you. I know the lecture has gone on a little long, but I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
It's important to understand that the woodblocks are as hard and as strong as they can be. If you have three different blocks for three different stones, each block would be painted in white, and then a master drawing would be used to replicate each different surface. Once those three blocks are prepared, then each individual block is cut according to the requirement of the tone that then has to be applied on top of the
other. Correct. So I've actually prepared for this question. So, yes, first to address the issue of the woodblock. So we don't have any surviving woodblocks from the Renaissance to actually confirm this scientifically, but we know from early writing that the preferred block wood to be used would be typically something like pear or fruit wood, which is hard enough that it can withstand the repeated pressure and use in a press, but also is soft enough that it can actually be cut. Now, in order to, the second part of your question, in order to distribute the design over multiple blocks, the way we understand printmakers to have worked is to start by what would be the compositional block, so the one block that holds the majority of the composition. So this one, you can see how a designer could conceive of this and design and cut this first. To design the subsequent blocks, which needed to be perfectly aligned in their design, the printmaker would print an impression of this block, and while the ink on this block, while the ink on this sheet of paper was still wet, it would be placed face down onto a second uncut virgin block. That would give the printmaker and the designer a template on which to work to establish the position of the white highlights. So you would then cut the highlights in this one, and then to print the, to design and cut the darker block, you would go back to this compositional block, print an impression, and while the ink is still wet, repeat the process, put this face down onto an uncut plank of wood, and then apply your darker, your scudo onto the block and cut that third block. So that's, that would ensure the accurate alignment of your, of the design of the successive blocks, but still kind of conceiving the color separation of some of the more complex designs. I'm not actually sure how it was achieved. Yes?
Why do you think there are empty blocks?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for this. As I mentioned, the chiaroscuro woodcut does fall out of fashion in the sort of the middle of the 17th century, and the blocks are reprinted towards the end of the 17th century. But once there is no market for these prints, the blocks are of no value, and so there was no reason to hold on to the blocks if you were not going to print from them. Another aspect of the block survival has to do with just the organic material of the wood blocks. These were susceptible to insect damage, to cracking, to warping, and so storing these blocks required quite a lot of care. So again, if you're not going to be reusing them, then there's really no purpose to taking all that care to store them. Yes.
How many different woodworking tools would be used then?
So the typical tools used to cut woodblocks would have been a knife and a gouge, and a chisel. So a printmaker would use a knife first to cut the edges of the forms, and then would use a gouge of different gauges and a chisel to excavate these areas. And it's wonderful because I hope you can see in this block, you can actually, or maybe here, you can just see the direction of the cutting of the block. So those were the typical tools that were used. Yes? I usually get that question from collectors, so I'm wondering if maybe that's the case here. So we don't know in the sense that the practice today that you see in workshops of numbering impressions, that's really a late 19th century phenomenon. So in this early modern period, impressions were not numbered. A printer or a publisher would keep printing as long as they could sell. And in fact, the blocks would change hands. And once one publisher had got its fill, then might sell the blocks onto another publisher, perhaps in a different city that had a separate market. So that's one aspect of this kind of continuous printing. In the course of research, I and my collaborator Linda surveyed about 2,500 to 3,000 impressions. And in 40 collections around the world. So we did do a survey. It's not exhaustive, but I think it gives us a relative sense of scale. And I will say that in the first room of the exhibition that you'll see, so it's the workshop of Ugo da Carpi, those prints are found in about 10 or fewer impressions. The most prolific workshop was that of Niccolò Vicentino, and the impressions that were issued from his workshop I think were recorded in about 35 impressions. So it's quite a small number. But then in the 17th century, for example, Niccolò Vicentino's woodblocks were reprinted by a publisher. And for every three impressions that were printed for every one impression that was printed by Vicentino, you'll now find about three 17th century impressions. So when counting impressions, it's also important to distinguish between what was an original workshop impression and what was a later printing. In terms of survival of these impressions, these were really high-end prints, and so they were collected from the time they were made, and were not functional prints. They weren't devotional images, they weren't popular prints. So these tended to be preserved in albums, and the owners of them took great care in preserving them. So there will always be a percentage of loss, but I think what survives today is a good reflection of what was made at the time. David.
You pointed out that you showed an example, so many of the early woodcuts were hand-colored. And of course, that means that they're all different from each other.
Correct.
And this process, interestingly, allows you to reproduce color in a graphic form and standardize it. It's reproducible and standardized. But as you've described it, there's a great deal of variation within this process of replication and standardizations. How much do you think that is due to technical matters, or is that aesthetic?
I think it's aesthetic. I think there was, and you see an evolution in terms of color over the course of the 16th century. So in the workshop of Ugo da Carpi, so the first generation, the palettes tend to be muted colors, pinks, blues, earth tones, colors that you actually do find in chiaroscuro drawings. And then, for example, in the Vicentino workshop in the 1540s, you have this high mannerist taste for color. So you have these very bold, saturated colors. And then towards the end of the century, there's this sort of return to the original taste for these very subtle earth tones. So I think when you see that, you do note that there is kind of an aesthetic taste of each different workshop. What's interesting, what I found very interesting when I showed you some of the colorants that were used, to make the inks. I will confess that going into the analysis of these prints, we analyzed about 72 different impressions between the Library of Congress and LACMA and the Grunewald Center. I actually went into it with Linda Stiber-Morenis and LACMA scientists, hoping that I would find scientific markers of the different workshops. And by that, I mean, I was hoping I would find that Ugo da Carpi only used particular colorants, and then that Vicentino used a different set of colorants or pigments, because I was hoping that I would have science to back up my slightly subjective art historical interpretation of their different workshops. What I found instead, which I should have anticipated, was that all the workshops used the same colorants. So what that means is if there is this very distinctive fingerprint of color, this kind of distinctive use of color in the different workshops, that is testament to the printer and the printer's ability to use the same ingredients and make very different looking printing inks. Yes?
You mentioned there was a revival of interest in the 1800s. Was that due to contact with the Japanese and the Japanese work?
No. So I will just briefly, in response to the Japanese issue. So technically, chiaroscuro woodcuts are similar in process to Japanese ukiyo-e woodblock prints in that you're working from multiple woodblocks, you're distributing a design over multiple blocks, you're dealing with registration, the alignment of the designs. However, in ukiyo-e prints, the aesthetic is descriptive. So the big wave is blue and the cherry blossoms are pink, whereas here we're dealing with an aesthetic of monochrome. The revival of the chiaroscuro woodcut in the 18th century, not the 1800s, was to do with its an interest in reproducing drawings. And this was a very different interest in printmaking than existed during the Renaissance. And so there were different printmaking techniques that were developed that could emulate the appearance of drawings. And so within that interest, chiaroscuro was revived to that end. Yes?
How do you distinguish an early imprint from one from the 17th century, besides color or?
There are a couple of things. So first, one can distinguish the relative age of the impression based on wear to the blocks. So as I mentioned earlier, the blocks are organic material. They're susceptible to damage, but also just to wear. So if you see that there's a lot of damage in the blocks, you understand that that's a later impression than an earlier impression that doesn't have that damage. The way we were able to put these in to group them also was to look at the watermark evidence. So the paper that was manufactured during this period held a watermark, the mill's manufacturing mark. And although it's not possible to date and localize impressions based on watermarks because paper traveled, it was sold, it was used. But when you start to find these groupings of impressions that the blocks are worn, the watermark information is consistent, but also the inks are consistent, you can start to see these groupings, additions. I'm using this because that's a much later concept, but additions where a group of impressions were printed together. And so that's how we in this project sort of were able to establish a chronology of the printings. I see a couple of more questions. Yes. Yes.
For his work, for his special work. And my question is, by that time, the idea of patents, I assume, was not widely available or available. And how did he, in fact, since woodblocks were changing, you know, from one person to another, how did he protect him, in fact, or did it?
There are several questions in there. So It's important to understand that the privilege is not the equivalent of a copyright. It was not that there is sort of a concept of intellectual property behind the design. So what Ugo was trying to protect with his Venetian privilege was the process. So as you said, it's closer in that regard to, say, a patent. Now at the time, there were different types of privileges that were being issued. And the purpose for this was because the initial financial outlay for producing a print was enormous. You had to pay your designer, you had to pay your printmaker, you had to buy a lot of paper, you had to buy ink, so forth. And the return on your investment was very slow. So it's not unlike producing a book today, where you pay your authors, pay your illustration, rights and reproduction fees, your designer, you print the book, and you put in a huge amount of money in the front end, and then you're selling your book for $9.99 on Amazon. And so you have to sell a huge number of impressions to recoup your cost. So the purpose of applying for this kind of patent was just to kind of maintain some monopoly over the market to, you know, buy time, basically, so that you could start to recoup your investments. And this was, these privileges were often requested, therefore, by book publishers because, you know, for that very reason. It's unclear how successful patents privileges really were, because you do see a fair amount of copying and sort of infringements of these privileges. But what I will say in the case of Ugo is that it must have been somewhat successful, because it's not until the late 1520s, when Ugo himself teaches the process to a second printmaker, that you have more chiaroscuros being produced in Italy. So I think it must have had some effect. I'm going to take this final question. Yes.
Just about the 17th century reprints, the same blocks you're seeing. I was curious where and sort of who. Can you tell us a little more about who did the later impressions?
In the 17th century? Yes. And do you mean new chiaroscuros or the reprinting? So you do have one 17th century chiaroscurist who was making new compositions. His name was Bartolomeo Coriolano, and he worked in Bologna. In terms of the identities of 17th century publishers, in only one case do we know the actual identity of the publisher, and that was Andrea Andreani, who we saw in the final section of the exhibition after he does this monumental triumph of Caesar. He then has sort of a career 2.0 and decides that he's going to become a publisher and focus his energies to reprinting the blocks of earlier block cutters. And we know that because he actually added his publisher's address to the blocks. It's very rare. I mean, that's the only case that we know of an Italian publisher adding his name to a woodblock. So in the other cases, we don't know the exact identities of the publisher, but we can, again, place the printing in the 17th century because we have this later paper being used. Thank you all for your attention. I hope you enjoy the exhibition.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.